Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And the Senate has confirmed a new Supreme Court justice. Neil Gorsuch has the votes to become the 113th justice on the nation's highest court after a historic change in Senate rules. We'll get to that in just a few minutes. But first, to the U.S. launch of 59 Tomahawk missiles against a Syrian airbase in response to an apparent chemical weapon attack earlier this week. Russia, which is a close ally of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, is condemning the U.S. missile strike. Joining us from Beirut, Lebanon, is the BBC's Ben James. And Ben, what reaction are you hearing from Syria and the region?
We've been watching a lot of Syrian state TV today to find out exactly how the Syrian authorities are responding to what's happened. An army spokesperson was the first official response we had on that channel, talking about, first of all, the destruction at the airbase itself, talking about six personnel having been killed there, and also the destruction that took place, of course, the US targeting infrastructure like planes and fuel for them, the ammunition to put on board as well. And then also we heard from the Syrian presidency, who put out a statement, the office of Bashar al-Assad, talking about this being irresponsible, in their view, on the part of the American government, and also saying that their resolve is not going to waver, saying that they will continue to do what they've been doing in Syria, which, in their view, is tackling what they call the terrorist groups, which for them is every opposition force opposing them in their country.
So there's no sense of how Assad may respond militarily to this, if at all.
There is no sense of that. They're doubling down, really, on how they've been operating already. We know that there have been further airstrikes through the day. There was a report even in the town of Khan Shaykhun, where this alleged chemical attack took place earlier in the week, where we saw all of those awful videos of people, children, many of them, suffering from the effects of chemical substances. There was a report earlier on today of a barrel bomb being dropped there. No casualties reported on the ground, but the bombardment of that northwestern region that's controlled by a variety of opposition groups, from jihadists to others that fight under the banner of the Free Syrian Army. There's no sign that the way that President Assad's government and their allies of the Iranians, the Russians, Hezbollah and others are going to continue to deal with that the same way.
There are reports today that the Syrians had some advanced warning and were able to move some equipment out of the way before those missiles struck. Is that what you're hearing?
There is an established protocol between the Americans and the Russians. A memorandum of understanding was signed in October 2015, shortly after the Russians became actively involved alongside their Syrian allies. It's essentially to stop Russian and American planes flying into each other or getting in each other's way, because, of course, the consequences of those two countries coming into open conflict are very, very difficult for anyone to comprehend on the world stage. So the assumption is that with the American military warning the Russians that the operation was due to take place, of course, the Russians would then warn their Syrian allies that the attack was coming. Now, we understand from reports from Russian state media journalists on the airbase, they say that 9 aeroplanes were destroyed. We can't corroborate that. I guess even if that is the case, what the Americans might be thinking and Donald Trump's government might be thinking is that the symbolism of this strike, the demonstration that they're prepared to retaliate to something like the chemical attack that they accused President Assad of on Tuesday, that is enough to put the message to President Assad that they will respond if they feel they need to.
Is this a game changer in the ongoing civil war in Syria and the war against ISIS in Syria?
It certainly gives a new dimension to the conflict. I think people now will be digesting around the world exactly what this might mean from their own group or country's point of view. So we will wait to see if it does change the nature of how the Syrian government, for example, engages the groups that they're fighting around the country, whether we will see any more accusations of chemical attacks, or maybe the behaviour of the Syrian government might change, even if in words they say they're going to carry on as before.
That's the BBC's Ben James joining us from Beirut, Lebanon. Ben, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, this morning, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi wrote a letter to Speaker Paul Ryan, urging him to call the House back in session from recess to ensure that Congress lives up to its constitutional responsibility of debating a new war authorization. Now, the current authorizations for military force date back to the 2001 9/11 attacks and the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Since then, Congress rejected President Obama's calls for authorizations in Libya, in Syria. So the old 2001 authorization covers fighting ISIS terrorists. But President Trump's attack was against the government in Syria, not ISIS, and some lawmakers believe it needs congressional approval. There's also been bipartisan support for the strikes, some tempered. Here's Senator John McCain, chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee on MSNBC.
I think it was appropriate, but I would like to say, despite all the enthusiasm we see this morning, if I might quote Churchill, it's the end of the beginning, not the beginning of the end.
Let's bring in the Friday Roundtable. Rick Klein, political director at ABC News, and Maria Elena Salinas, news anchor at Univision. Welcome to you both.
Hello. Good to talk to you.
President Trump's hard-right nationalist supporters, Maria Elena, are blasting him. Some alt-right outlets don't even believe there was a gassing. They think it's a false flag to draw the U.S. in. But establishment Republicans, liberals like Nick Kristof, are approving of the strikes. Hillary Clinton called for them before they happened. Tell us more about this scramble in Washington as people, you know, decide how they feel about this.
I know it's interesting because everyone's focusing now on the political fight in Congress over more than the consequences of this attack. I mean, besides the bilateral support that we are seeing in Congress, you know, there's also international support from U.S. allies. So far, around a dozen countries have expressed their support, including the U.K., Germany, France, Israel, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia. The question is, will that support turn into action? And will these countries be part of a coalition if there is more military action? You know, I think right now everyone is reacting to this one event, but right now there are so many more questions than there are answers. What is next? Will there be more strikes? Will Trump declare war on Syria unilaterally? Will he go to Congress and ask for approval?
Yeah, Rick Klein, what are questions for you?
I want to know what the Trump doctrine is, because we now know that the president is willing to rewrite his own doctrine, ignore what he has said as a candidate, ignore what he has maintained his administration policy up until a couple of days ago based just on one event. And it was a horrific event, and the photos were shocking. But the fact that permitted him, in his mind, to change course just 80 days into this administration, just less than 80 hours after the incident itself, suggests a decisiveness, maybe an unpredictability. And I think a kind of freewheeling decision-making nature that a lot of folks around the world are trying to figure out, because this is not the President Trump that we thought we'd get from the campaign. It's not the man who seemed to project himself onto the world stage throughout as an answer to both Obama and Bush, the last two presidents of each party.
Well, President Trump said on the campaign trail, "I'm not the president of the world." And Marco Rubio is one who's praising him today, but he was one who suggested that the Trump administration may have emboldened Syrian President Assad to even make that apparent gas attack, because just last week, Trump's Secretary of State said regime change in Syria was not a U.S. priority. Maria Elena, I'm thinking of some other fallout issues there might be. Last night you tweeted, "Will Trump now change his mind on accepting Syrian refugees? Those victims of the gas attack he's deploring are the ones that look for refuge."
Exactly. I think that's one of the first things that came to my mind when you hear Trump talk about these poor babies and these poor kids, and you see these images of you know, people who were attacked, laying dead, mothers, babies, men who lost their entire family. You know, those are the very refugees fleeing from Syria, trying to find a home elsewhere to raise their families in peace. So I'm wondering if he changing his mind on regime change? Is he changing his mind on whether or not he wants to get involved in Syria? Will he also change his mind on accepting more Syrian refugees? And maybe that executive order that freezes all refugees from entering the country for 90 days, maybe he won't fight it in the courts anymore.
We'll see. I mean, it's the Colin Powell line, if you break it, you own it. Rick, what else is going on here? These strikes take place as there was an apparent power struggle between Trump's chief strategist, Steve Bannon, pulled from the National Security Council, and Trump's son-in-law and advisor, Jared Kushner. Kushner is said to be winning. What's going on here?
Well, if you needed an example of Bannon losing, it would seem to be intervention in Syria. This is exactly the kind of globalist mindset in Bannon's view that he tends to oppose. We don't know what private advice he gave to the president. There has been a pretty fierce influence struggle that includes, by the way, Secretary of State Tillerson, as well as the Defense Secretary, Jim Mattis. And they have, by all accounts, aligned more with Jared Kushner, who has become something of a conduit to Capitol Hill and some of the Republican establishment voices. So a whole big scrambling going on, but I think a move away from the ideology of Steve Bannon, which was very skeptical about in any kind of intervention, any kind of adventurism in the Middle East as he would see it. And I think this is a pretty dramatic example of that fading influence.
One quick question, Maria Elena, we just have a few seconds, but we have a new Supreme Court Justice, Gorsuch. Is the Senate going to heal from how that
I don't know. I think that this whole issue with the nuclear option and the filibuster, it just shows how divided Congress is. And even though Democrats try to justify their filibuster, it really, the move might have backfired on them, because not only do they still get Gorsuch on the Supreme Court, but now all future nominees will be confirmed with a simple majority. Right. So unless Democrats regain power in the Senate, the country will have a conservative-leaning Supreme Court for the foreseeable future.
Maria Elena Salinas of Univision, Rick Klein of ABC News. To be continued. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now a moment for reflection with Bruce Feiler. His books and TV shows and TED Talks and columns in the New York Times have helped us wrestle with religions. He walks readers through the Bible literally as he retraces the steps of biblical figures with fresh eyes. And now he's asking us to rethink Adam and Eve. Bruce says we've got them all wrong. Eve wasn't a lesser human made from Adam's rib to lure him to sin. There are no apples in Iraq where the story was set. The word fall isn't even in the Bible. No, Eve was cleaved from Adam's side. And Bruce says the story is about a great and equal marriage. His new book is The First Love Story, Adam, Eve, and Us. He joins us from Cake Mix Recording Studio in Dallas. Bruce Feiler, welcome back.
Nice to be with you. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, so what you do in this book is take a story that we think we know, pull a thread, it unravels, but suddenly we roll up a new ball of yarn with Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, John Milton's Paradise Lost, Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel, Sissy Spacek and Carrie. We remember her mother screamed at her that Eve loosed a raven on the world and the raven was sin and the first sin was intercourse. You say Eve has been victim of the greatest character assassination in the world.
For me, Robin, as you know, my process begins at the kitchen table. I have a working wife. I have identical twin daughters. And we are just struggling on a daily basis to try to figure out the changing way that men and women are relating to each other. And this journey for me began on a visit to the Sistine Chapel with my daughters looking up at the ceiling and looking at Adam and God and saying, where am I in this picture? And I realized that one story, this story, has been at the heart of all these conversations about family and sexuality and gender identity for all these years. And when I kind of went back and started looking at it, I realized we've got the story wrong, that this story was weaponized as a way to elevate men and keep down women. And if we're going to have some meaning from the past in the middle of this conversation, we have to see the story for what it's really saying to us.
Yeah, I'm going to jump to the end because you go through so many rabbit holes. You mentioned the Sistine Chapel. Yes, there's the image we remember of God touching the outstretched finger of Adam. But Eve is there, tucked in under God's other arm. So she is there. But your point is your daughter's like, well, what does this mean for me? And I'm going to go to sort of the end of the story. You talk to relationship experts. You know, Eve may have been the first teacher, the first to have her eyes opened, and that Eve and Adam walk out of the garden equals.
What is powerful at the story is when you go back, you realize we have not really been reading the story. We've been hearing the layers of commentary that organized religion has been putting upon it. And when you go back to the story, there are two stories. First of all, the second story, as you know, has Adam being created from the earth, Eve being created from his body. It's not a rib. It's the side. Mm. You know, Eve going off and eating the fruit. It's the fruit of knowledge. You can call it a sin. You can call it discretion or whatever. But they still stay together. God blesses them. They have two children. That goes wrong. They have another, and that populates that child. Seth goes on to populate the human line. God needs this story to be a success, and it is a success. But when you go back to the beginning, to the first story in Genesis 1, God creates one human creation, divides it into male and female. The entire story begins with equality. And you say jumping to the end. Today, 30 centuries after the story was first written down, as men and women today stand equally before God. That was a hard-earned victory that involved going back and pulling apart the layers of kind of discrimination that were layered onto this story, going back to the original story where we can see equality, a seesawing of power, an equilibrium. That's what the story is trying to say to us.
As opposed to a treacherous, subservient woman. Look, there's so much here. Columbus believed in the Garden of Eden. He was searching for it. There was a famous German couple who went to the Galapagos to create their own Eden. That doesn't go well. But start with John Milton, because you say he did more than anyone to advance this theory that this is a love story about a compassionate marriage, which, you know, prior to this, that had been a crime in some places to actually love your wife. So what did Milton do?
I'm an experientialist, as you know. I like to go places. And one of the challenges is, where am I going to go, right? Because I can go to the Garden of Eden in Iraq, but that's really the only place to go. It turns out when I start tugging on strings, Robin, I at every moment of transition in the family, people have gone back to the stories. Michelangelo, Milton, you mentioned Mary Shelley. So I got to go on this incredible scavenger hunt around the world. And in some ways, the most pivotal place was London. So it's here in the 17th century that John Milton, he goes and he gets married. He's a romantic. His wife, they go on their honeymoon. She goes back to visit her family, never returns again to her husband. It's an incredible story. He writes five tracts saying that divorce, which at the time was illegal, should be legal, because how do you justify anything in 17th century? Go back to the Bible. Adam and Eve have a great marriage. They have apt and cheerful conversation. They are supportive. Late in his life, after kind of being exiled from the government, he goes and he writes Paradise Lost, which is a step-by-step argument that the two of them were in love. In effect, John Milton invents the idea of a love marriage. The two are together. They're cheerful. They're happy. They have wedded bliss. She goes off and eats the fruit, and she says, "Oh, well, I should keep the power for myself. But I can't, so dear, I miss Adam." So she goes back. Adam, he knows he should be dutiful, but oh, I love my wife. The two of them choose each other. It's an affirmative, powerful choice. And even though it's called Paradise Lost, when they leave, they are hand in hand toward a far happier place. He invents, elevates the story as the love story that it is.
Well, and there was thinking that the fall was actually God's plan, was a good thing, because it gave humans something to overcome. You know, it sets that course. Look, you mentioned Adam and Eve as parents. They're parents who bear the death of a child at the hands of another son, Cain and Abel. You go off and meet one of the mothers of the Columbine shooters. You know, what must Eve have felt like to have a son who was murdered? And a son who was a murderer. You go to support groups for families of murdered children. You take us off on that tangent. You remind us what incredible parents they were. One of the saddest chapters, though, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, the suffragist, actually rewrote this story and the Bible during the early women's rights movement. And that was her fall and her fallout with Susan B. Anthony.
I love this story, and it's the story people have quoted most to me from the first love story. Eve, in many ways, is the primary actor in the story of Adam and Eve. And yet, for the first 28 centuries that people talked about it, only men talked about it publicly. As soon as women began to talk about it in the 19th century, our understanding of the story begins to change. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, in 1848, with Anthony, invents the women's rights movement. Basically, Stanton is the brains behind it, but she's got seven kids and a husband who's off. Anthony would come and say, "I need a speech." So Anthony's the public face. The two of them fight for women's rights in property, in custody, in voting, and they keep hitting a wall. What happens? People say, well, women can't have property rights because the Bible says Eve was created second, or women can't vote because the Bible says that Eve was created from Adam's rib. So Stanton decides that her biggest problem, and if women are ever going to have equality, they have to fight not politicians but preachers. And she needs to rewrite the story of Adam and Eve, and she does. In her 70s, in 1895, she publishes a book called The Woman's Bible that goes back to Genesis 1. And she says, look, here in Genesis 1, our Creator has male and female equal. That was the intention. The book is a landmark. It's a bestseller. It's a disaster. Essentially, the movement that she started gathers in Baltimore, takes a vote, and kicks her out. She's one of the most famous women in America. And we don't think of her today because she took on Adam and Eve and got flattened. It was another century until the second wave of feminism that we first understood her story and that women finally reclaimed the equality that is at the heart of the story itself.
I love that you tell that story now. Look, address the people, Bruce, who've been listening to us for several minutes now and saying, people, it's not true. You know, it's not, you don't really believe that, do you? What, you know, talk about your sense of, you know, how you accept these stories in the new form that you've created. You know, it's fairy tale to some, allegory to others. What is it to you?
I think of what the biblical archaeologist Avraham Biran, the first man to have a PhD in archaeology, said to me. He said, I don't know if Adam and Eve existed then, but I know that they exist now. There they are in the Sistine Chapel, in Paradise Lost, in Mark Twain's vision, in Beyonce, in Pope Francis, 10 yards from where I stood to see him in Philadelphia.
Well, hold on. Mark Twain, Beyonce?
The Mark Twain story is amazing. He goes to Jerusalem and discovers Adam and has this emotional connection to his forefather, as he called him. He comes back. He tells the creators of the Statue of Liberty to replace Lady Liberty with Adam. Like, and when his wife dies, he writes the most beautiful passage. He has Adam say of his wife what Twain said of his: wherever Eve went, there was Eden. This story, at every moment in transition for the last 3,000 years, people have gone to find meaning in it. And what I'm saying, why it matters today, is that we're in another moment of transition in relationships and gender and sexuality and family. And look at the Bible, okay? Who are all the big figures? Noah, Abraham, Moses, Solomon, David, Jesus, Paul. They're all singles. Who is the first couple? It's Adam and Eve. Not Adam, not Eve. Adam and Eve. And it matters today when relationships have become a commodity, when we have reality television and tabloids, it matters that our first relationship be a success. There is promised love in the Bible as well as promised land. We need to remember Adam and Eve as the success that they are the first love story.
That's Bruce Feiler. His new book is The First Love Story, Adam, Eve, and Us. You can read an excerpt at herenow.org. Bruce, always a pleasure.
Thank you, Robin.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you everything you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste, and it's delivered right to your door. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying seasonally inspired recipes and exploring new flavors and cuisines. No commitment. Get the meals only when you want. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/here.
Seattle is moving ahead with plans to create sites for addicts to consume or inject drugs under the supervision of medical personnel. These so-called safe sites aim to save lives and connect people with addictions to treatment services. San Francisco, Burlington, Vermont are considering similar sites. And now the Massachusetts Medical Society wants its members to support the sites in that state. Martha Biebinger from Here and Now contributor WBUR reports.
Let's acknowledge up front the reaction many people have to this idea.
To set up a place where addicted people would go and shoot up heroin, to me, sounds crazy.
That's William Brooks, the chief of police in Norwood, Massachusetts. He says he knows the Medical Society's goal would be to save lives.
And that's a laudable goal. We share that. But I just don't think that that's the direction we ought to be going in. It does feel like we're giving up, like we're throwing our hands up. And I don't think we should do that.
Hold on, says Dr. Dennis Dimitri. He's a former president of the Massachusetts Medical Society. He says this is not about throwing in the towel.
And saying, okay, if you're going to use drugs, we'll just help you use drugs. It's really about trying to get individuals into an environment where they have a much better chance of surviving their substance use disorder to make progress in recovery.
So there you have two views on this controversial topic that the Medical Society trustees will bring before members for a vote later this month. The Medical Society says fewer people who use drugs in a safe injection facility have died as compared to the streets, and doctors and nurses are able to persuade more patients to try treatment. But is it ethical for a physician to be in a room where patients are doing something illegal and potentially dangerous? Dimitri says yes, because doctors would be helping patients with addiction, a brain disease.
We felt that the ethics of doing this were justifiable, that putting a program such as this in place would do more benefit than any harm.
Dimitri says given the scope of the opioid epidemic, it's time to give doctors and nurses more tools to stop drug overdoses. Massachusetts estimates nearly 2,000 deaths last year. The CDC estimates that on average, about 91 Americans die every day from an opioid overdose.
That number has gone up dramatically and shows no signs of abating anytime soon. So given that, we think it's important that we use our bully pulpit to be leaders on this issue.
That means, in short, persuading a city or town to allow this illegal activity and then getting an exemption from or changing state drug possession, consumption, and conspiracy laws. Leo Beletsky, who teaches law at Northeastern University, outlined the options for the medical society.
It does take some measure of discretion on the part of state and federal officials to allow such experimentation to proceed, but it is possible.
There is legislation filed at the Massachusetts State House that would allow safe injection facilities. It hasn't moved so far this session. But even if it passed, Beletsky says there's a question of how the Trump administration would respond to a room full of active drug users.
Will they choose to use their enforcement discretion to go after a public health facility of the sort? The answer to that is unknown.
23-year-old Nicholas Chu is not deterred. He's the Boston University medical student who first brought the idea of supervising drug users to the medical society more than a year ago.
It's important to recognize that sometimes in situations you have to make a compromise for the greater good. And I think, you know, dead patients can't be saved.
For Here and Now, I'm Martha Biebinger.
For more than a decade, Puerto Rico has been caught in a slow-motion crisis. A lingering recession and lack of opportunities have driven tens of thousands of Puerto Ricans to leave the island each year. Many, especially young people and recent graduates, have moved to the U.S. mainland for jobs. But on a recent visit to Puerto Rico, NPR's Greg Allen found a growing number of professionals who believe their future is on the island.
You find them opening restaurants and management consulting firms or running schools and nonprofits. In San Juan, nearly 20 social service groups and for-profit startups share space in an airy, recently renovated building.
You can also see over here the green incorporation of the,
building.
Outside on the patio, there's a waterfall and vertical garden. Anna Maria Vidal runs the Community for Collaboration and Social Innovation, a co-working space for people and groups thinking about how to build Puerto Rico's future.
There are a couple of co-working spaces in Puerto Rico, but this is the only one that joins nonprofits and then startups.
On a visit there recently, more than a dozen of these dreamers sat around a table to talk about why, unlike nearly a half million Puerto Ricans in the last decade, they made a conscious decision to stay on the island. Jorge Besu, a marketing consultant, says for years companies in Puerto Rico would look to the government for contracts and subsidies. With the island's ongoing financial crisis, for the new generation of entrepreneurs, that's no longer an option.
We don't depend on the government. Even non-for-profit organizations here are looking for social entrepreneurship models. So the model has changed. We don't expect anything from the government.
Besu was laid off in 2011 after his company restructured. He says in Puerto Rico today, you have two options, leave or create your own opportunities. He started his own firm in Puerto Rico. That decision, whether to stay on the island or make a future on the U.S. mainland, is one that nearly every young Puerto Rican faces. Michael Fernandez is a lawyer who comes from a large family.
We are 13 cousins in my father's side of my family. And there's only three of us left in Puerto Rico. Everybody left in the past 5 years. But it's a conscious decision to stay here.
After graduation, Fernandez had job offers from law firms. But he says he wanted to help make Puerto Rico better and decided he'd rather work with low-income communities.
Because there is a lack of social justice in Puerto Rico, it's that we have a lot of the problems and the crisis that we're living right now. And I'd rather assume responsibility and occupy a position of leadership as opposed to look around me to see who else would do it or leave and let somebody else deal with it.
Puerto Rico has been a U.S. territory for more than a century. Even so, people who grow up there have a powerful affinity for the island, which they commonly refer to as El País, the country. But after a decade of recession and a lingering financial crisis, Rebecca Gonzalez says Puerto Rico is a place with very low self-esteem. She sees it in the students she works with at an alternative high school. Her challenge, she says, is teaching the next generation to love themselves and the place they come from.
Most of us here, we've said, I don't know, maybe it's a good idea to leave because it's tough, you know. But then you think about it and you're like, this country has given me so much. And we love our heritage and we know who we are and we love our language. So we say, let's stay and let's fight for it.
After a decade of lagging economic growth and surging out-migration, in this group of young entrepreneurs and activists, there's a real sense of optimism and anticipation for what's next in Puerto Rico. Carlos Ruiz worked for more than 20 years for Mars Incorporated and other large U.S. companies before starting his own management consulting firm. He acknowledges that decision to stay and try something new carries more risk than leaving for a corporate job on the mainland. But Ruiz says the reward is much greater.
Because it's where our values are, or our family. In my case, all my family is still here. So I do have deep roots here. And I think when you leave your country, even if you become the next billionaire in that other country, I think you give up something.
Ruiz's business partner, Carlos Frontera, says reinventing your career isn't easy. But leaving your home and family is hard, too. And that's a path many thousands of Puerto Ricans are being forced to take.
They are crying their hearts to come back, but they can't.
They can't, he says, because they can't make enough to support their families in Puerto Rico. As it struggles to resolve its financial crisis, the island has many challenges ahead. Its biggest one may be convincing its next generation that their best opportunities are at home in Puerto Rico. Greg Allen, NPR News.
Chinese President Xi Jinping and President Trump are in their second day of meetings in Florida. We've been speaking with Chinese students. There are more than 300,000 in the U.S. We heard from one who hoped China could compromise on dumping cheap steel in the U.S. We hear that's in the talks. And today, Jasmine Shao at Amherst College in Massachusetts. She joins us by Skype. And Jasmine, what do you want to hear from the leaders?
I think for me, something that's really important is about some environmental issues. Because China has vowed to reduce greenhouse emissions, and U.S., its leader Trump seemed not to be very committed to reduce climate change.
Well, in fact, China, it said, is going to be taking over from the U.S. and taking the lead on doing something about climate change after President Trump rolled back many of President Obama's commitments to reversing the effects of climate change through emissions and such. How do you feel about that? The fact that, you know, for years it was President Obama trying to get China to take up some action on climate change. China is the largest emitter of greenhouse gases, followed closely by the U.S.
Well, I think President Trump seems to want to dismantle a lot of efforts in the past, for example, the Clean Power Plan. So I think if U.S. is going to pull out from Paris Agreement, then it will be a really disaster for the globe because U.S. is such a big emitter itself, and it shows example for other countries too.
Well, there's some irony there that we're hearing from a Chinese student about how the U.S. should step up on doing something about climate change. What about the comments President Trump made about China, especially in the presidential campaign? He said, we can't allow China to rape our country, and that's what they're doing.
Well, I think that it's a very contradicting thing for him to say because U.S. has always been the leader in globalization. And I think that China-U.S. trade is part of that globalization process. And I don't think that China's raping the U.S. in that it is U.S. customers who benefited from the increased trade transactions.
Well, you're absolutely right. We wouldn't have things like iPhones. You know, we couldn't afford them anyway if it wasn't for some of the production in China. But then there are questions about human rights abuses in those factories that make those iPhone parts. Also, currency manipulation, stealing of ideas by China. Your thoughts about the criticism of your own country?
I think there needs to be progress both in U.S. and China, as well as other countries regarding to intellectual property and other issues. But I also feel like we cannot expect something that takes decades or centuries to complete in U.S. and developed countries to be realized overnight in China.
Well, tell me a little bit more about that, Jasmine, because here you are studying at a prestigious school. Many of your countrymen are maybe a generation away from even thinking of going to school in that huge country that's going through a huge change. What would you want Americans to know about China?
I think that China is a growing country, but we have always been a harmonious country as well. For example, before Columbus set sail to the New World, Chinese sailor Zheng He has already had explored other parts of the world too, but without particular colonial intention. So I don't think we would be particularly aggressive in the process of developing. And also we have a phrase called 以和为贵, which means that cherish harmony. So we see harmony as something valuable.
Well, as you know, there's a lot of disharmony in your region. When it comes to North Korea, are you afraid of that country? Do you wish your country would do more to talk North Korea down from its weapons program? What's the thinking of a young Chinese person?
Well, I do hope that our country leader could step up the effort to facilitate peace talks. But I do think that the marginalization of North Korea is part of the reasons why there are developing such weapons. And I'm not saying so to justify their action. I'd strongly disagree with any such an attempt of the North Korea. But I think that trust as well as peaceful communication instead of threats and fear would be a better approach to solving the problem.
Thank you, Jasmine.
Thank you.
Jasmine Chow, a Chinese student studying at Amherst College in Massachusetts.
President Trump's decision to launch more than 50 missiles at a Syrian airbase has stirred debate around the world on what to do next. The Russian and Iranian governments condemned the strike, which came just days after the Syrian government's apparent use of chemical weapons that killed at least 80 civilians. The missile launch has also sharply divided members of Congress. Earlier today, Democratic Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia, the former vice presidential candidate, spoke with Morning Edition.
I voted to use military action against Syria in 2013 when they used chemical weapons against civilians. But I am very critical of President Trump for taking this action without coming to Congress first. A president is not supposed to initiate war without a vote of Congress. And a military action, a missile strike against a sovereign nation is an act of war.
Joining us now is Republican Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma, a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee. Senator, welcome.
Well, nice to be with you.
And what do you think of President Trump's decision to launch airstrikes against the Assad regime in Syria?
I just am so pleased that he made the decision, that he acted quickly, he acted properly, he acted within his authority. And, you know, there's Jeremy, there's some other reasons. We've gone through 8 years with a president who's not decisive, a president who did not want to use the authority that he had, and the president who didn't come out with a plan as to how do we handle future problems in Syria and other places where there is a type of genocide that may be going on.
But I'm sure you've seen at this point the tweets from President Trump during the Obama years where he said, do not attack inside Syria.
Well, he said yes at that time. Of course, he wasn't president of the United States at that time, and he had not personally been exposed to the things that happened during this. I mean, just the magnitude of it. So I can certainly see that he would feel differently as president when he knows he can do something about it, and he knows he can stop, you know, multitudes of children from being gassed and tortured to death. And I think that's obviously he looks at things differently as president than he did when he was an outside critic.
What do you say to people like your colleague, Republican Senator Rand Paul, who says the president needs congressional authorization for military action as required by the Constitution?
It's not required by the Constitution. He does not need authorization of that. He is authorized, any president is authorized to use immediate limited force, and that's exactly what he did. There's one thing that has been overlooked, what this president, President Trump, has said many times. He said, when we're going to do something, we're not going to advertise it over you guys, and over the radio, over the media, because we don't want the enemies to know what we're doing. That's common sense. And so he made the proper response immediately after the tragedy took place, and then he went ahead and did it without the authority, and of course he did not need that authority. So I disagree. I can assure you that Rand Paul is wrong in this case.
But would you want the president to come to Congress at this point if he's going to get more involved in the fight in Syria?
Well, so far that hasn't happened. Let's look, you've got something where right now this has all the appearance of being the proper thing. Look at the people who are supporting us right now. I mean, France, Germany, Iran, Israel, even China is supporting the action that we've taken. And for the first time in 8 years, they know that if a president says something, he will do it and he will act decisively.
Do you think that the U.S. should now lead an effort to remove President Assad from power?
Well, I think that we've actually been doing that, for quite some time. We've wanted to get rid of that individual, and so I don't think that's actually changed. Now, as to what he would do, I think the action that was taken is going to have one step in that direction, because you have outsiders out there that are looking and saying, he doesn't have the strong foothold that he'd like to have. I'm talking about Assad now. And I think one of the reasons for him to take these heinous acts against helpless people is to reestablish his control. I think this did a lot against his maintenance of control.
But there are some people who think that he was emboldened by some of the comments last week from Secretary of State Tillerson and the UN ambassador Nikki Haley, essentially saying that his future is up to the Syrian people.
Well, I think that up to the Syrian people, but how are the Syrian people going to respond to this?
One more question, Senator. Do you think that U.S. airstrikes against Syria in this way put the U.S. into possible military conflict with Russia? Are you concerned about that?
Not at all concerned about that. You got to keep in mind that Russia was actually tipped off before this took place. And I think that Russia will gain a new respect for the United States. And I think that'll be the response more than a fear of a war with Russia. I think Russia will now start respecting us as a world leader and as someone who will use their resources to respond to terrorism.
That's James Inhofe, a senator, Republican senator from Oklahoma. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jerry.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.